8% chance that it won't. He'll take the 98% risk, just to show he took the challenge and did what everyone else said couldn't be done. It may take years, and all kinds of work no one else will ever see, but eventually a cleaner is going to own that situation and make it work to his advantage. He has to. It's the only way he knows. This didn't work, so let's do that. If that doesn't work, we can do this. How many ways can you prepare? How many different pathways can you create so you don't eventually run into a ditch? And even if you do run into the ditch, how many options do you have for getting out? It fascinates me to hear the criticism of Michael as the owner and GM of the Charlotte Bobcats. After 4 years as a minority partner, Michael took control in 2010 and became the first former player to become the majority owner of an NBA team. Cleaner law? If your name is on the door, you'd better control what goes on behind that door. Right away, the critics pounced on the team's poor performance, questioning whether the Bobcats' failure would tarnish Michael's legacy, and comparing him to other players who had made the leap to management. Larry Bird, Joe DeMars, Jerry West. Great executives who did great things with the teams they worked for. But that's the difference. They all worked for someone else. Michael is working for himself. It's his money. His name on that door. There's a big difference between being hired for a job that you'll eventually leave, voluntarily or involuntarily, and owning the business, which has never before been done in the NBA by a former player. How can you fail at something that's never been done, when there's no previous measure of success? After a terrible 2011-2012 season, he blamed no one, took full responsibility for the team situation, and said he was going to figure it out. Probably doesn't help that the team's best player is actually its owner. But when Michael says, "I never want to be in the record books for failure," as he told reporters after the season, believe him. Let's make this simple. Failure is what happens when you decide you failed. Until then, you're still always looking for ways to get where you want to be. It's Derek Jeter responding to a reporter who asked if the Yankees were panicking during a late-season slump and how Jeter was dealing with it. He said, "I don't panic, so I don't have to deal with it." Total cleaner. Or Dallas Cowboys tight end Jason Witten, offering to sign a medical waiver so he could return to action with a lacerated spleen against doctor's orders. It's Dwayne refusing to go down with that bad knee in the playoffs, or Kobe refusing to sit out with multiple injuries, including the concussion, that would have staggered anyone else. That's how you decide to not fail. You go, and you go, always looking for the unexpected option that keeps the situation in your control. Success and failure are 100% mental. One person's idea of success might seem like a complete failure to someone else. You must establish your own vision of what it means to be unstoppable. You can't let anyone else define that for you. What does your gut tell you? What do your instincts know about what you should be doing, how you're going to succeed, and what you're going to succeed at? How can anyone tell you what that should be? When someone else says you've failed, what they really mean is, if that were me, I would feel like a failure. Well, that guy's not you, and he's obviously not a cleaner, because cleaners don't recognize failure. I understand the challenge of fighting back against all odds while others want you to fail. When I built the Attack Athletics facility in Chicago in 2007, I had already been in business for almost 20 years. I had already worked with the best athletes in the world, traveled to places and seen things others can only dream of, and I wanted to take Attack Athletics to the next level. Everyone said it was the final stage in my evolution as a trainer. But to me, it was just the beginning. I built a state-of-the-art athletic training facility that brought people from all over the world, a place that no other individual trainer could ever have dreamed of building and owning. I had certain expectations and plans, and they all came to fruition. The new venture was everything I wanted it to be. But as with any business, unexpected situations force you to make adjustments, and I was faced with difficult decisions that would change the direction of the facility. Players facing the NBA lockout didn't want to make the financial investment in their training without the certainty of a season. My major clients, Kobe, Dwayne, and many others, understandably wanted me wherever they were, so I was all over the world with them while my building was sitting in Chicago. Hard way to run a business. And before long, there was some buzz about the failure of Attack Athletics. What happened with the building was a setback. But dealing with setbacks is how you achieve success. You learn, and you adapt. When everyone else is talking about how you failed, you show up like a professional, remap your course, and get back to work. That's the progression of good, great, unstoppable. No one starts at unstoppable. You fuck up. You figure it out. You trust yourself. Let me say this. Attack Athletics is who I am and what I do. It's not a building. The building was about equipment, an environment, and a revolutionary concept. Attack Athletics is me and my training philosophy, and it goes wherever I go. Attack Athletics is the work I do all over the world, and I work hard to be sure that my clients and I don't fail at anything we do. We always find a way to make it work. But when you're the best at anything, you wear a big target on your back. When your colleagues and friends and enemies start talking and sniping behind your back, you know you've done something right if they care that much about you and your business, and whether you're going to lose. Lose? What I lose, you never had. A cleaner never sees failure because to him it's never over. If something doesn't go as planned, he instinctively looks for options to make things work a different way. He doesn't feel embarrassed or ashamed. He doesn't blame anyone else, and he doesn't care what anyone else says about his situation. It's never the end. It's never over. And he knows without a doubt that whatever happens, he'll find a way to come out on top. If you ever find me and a bear wrestling in the woods, help the bear. Make the choice to turn failure into success. If your team doesn't win a championship, if your business falls apart, if you don't achieve something you worked for, move to the next step in your evolution. Remember who you are and how you got this far. Listen to your gut. What is it telling you? It's never over. You have choices. The cooler admits defeat. The closer works hard, but the cleaner strategizes for a different outcome. Admitting defeat has no place in this discussion or in this book, because the words quit and relentless just don't work together in any productive way. People who admit defeat and say they had no choice just aren't serious about success, excellence, or themselves. They say they'll try and then give up when that doesn't work. Fuck try. Trying is an open invitation to failure, just another way of saying, if I fail, it's not my fault. I tried. You tried your best, or did you do your best? Huge difference. Well, I tried. Okay, now tell me what you did. Do or don't do. Do it, and if it doesn't work, do it again. Did you do it this way? That way? Did you explore every idea you had? Is there anything else you could possibly do to turn things in your favor? If you aim at excellence, you have to be willing to sacrifice. That is the price of success. You never know how bad you want it until you get that first bitter taste of not getting it. But once you taste it, you're going to fight like hell to get that bitterness out of your mouth. Maybe you got benched, or you lost a lot of money, or someone else got the promotion you wanted. Others might give up, and they'll be the first to say you should give up too. But did you stop because you wanted to, or because they told you to? Is there still work to be done? Do you still feel the anger inside you, driving you to take action and turn things around? A closer will keep going until he's forced to stop. Remember, he's called a closer because he's there at the end. But once the end arrives, he knows it, he feels it. It's over. A cleaner can't ever accept that it's over. But he does recognize when it's time to change direction. One of the hardest things to do is to change course once you've set your goals. You made a decision. You worked for it. You earned the payoff. But for whatever reason, it's not going the way you planned. It's not weak to recognize when it's time to shift directions. It's weak to refuse to consider other options and fail at everything because you couldn't adapt to anything. We've all been there. You just know something's not right. Maybe you're not advancing as quickly as you planned, or you're not making the money you anticipated, or maybe you just don't like what you're doing or whom you're doing it with, or maybe events outside of your control have impacted your situation. This is where instinct is the most valuable tool you can possibly possess, because only you can decide whether to hear what that voice inside is telling you. In pro sports, it's the decision to retire or to take a shot at one more season. For a young athlete, it's deciding whether to sit on the bench or to find a new sport to play. In business, it can be the choice to change careers or jobs, start or sell a business. In any situation, it's the courage and confidence to know it's time to make a change. It takes a special person to say enough is enough and know when it's time to start redirecting your effort into something that can succeed. Maybe your dream isn't going to play out the way you originally envisioned it, but with some creativity and vision, you can redirect your goals towards something that keeps you connected to what you always wanted. I can tell myself with no hesitation that I'm the best at what I do. I earned it. But to become the best, I had to learn a lot of lessons about always being prepared to change direction and refusing to get sucked into other people's opinions of what it means to succeed or fail. The first time I learned that lesson, I was a basketball player at University of Illinois Chicago with big dreams and a torn ACL. A botched rehab led to hip issues, leg issues, more knee issues. I have more orthopedic issues than you can imagine. I had no idea at that time that my greatest weakness would become my greatest strength, that experiencing every possible injury and surgery would allow me to help others to deal with the same at the most elite level. I was a pretty good player, but not NBA caliber. I just wasn't ready to admit it. When I suffered that first injury, all I wanted to do was play basketball. I'm not the most religious person, but to me, the torn ACL was a message saying, "Listen, you're spending too much time trying to work on this game. It's not going to happen. So let's just bust up your knee so you can focus on what you're supposed to do with your life and get you on the right path faster." But I wasn't ready to look at a different ending for my dream. I kept playing, wearing a big brace on my messed up knee, and trying to overcome the aftermath of the injury and disastrous rehab. Then one day, the turning point. I was playing in a tournament, and this kid I didn't even know came up to me and said, "I remember when you were good." Oh. Got it. That was the wake-up call. The message I needed to realize I was forcing a situation that had no chance of succeeding. It wasn't about the kid's comment. He was only saying what I already knew. I just hadn't accepted it yet. I played in one pickup game after that, and that was it. It was time to find a new ending for that dream. Learn. adapt. I realized if my damaged body couldn't help me play basketball, I would use what I learned and find a way to turn it into something positive. And I could already see what it was. I didn't want to work for a team. I wanted to work for myself. Take someone in basketball and make him better than he was before. That was how I would make my mark on the NBA. I guess it worked. Of course, it took me a little longer to figure out how that dream was actually going to take shape. I was still chasing Brad Sellers and the rest of the Bulls, writing them all letters, offering my training services. No one responded. I assumed Michael Jordan would be the least likely to hire a trainer, especially one who had never trained a professional athlete, so I never even contacted him. That's how I learned. Don't try. Do. Today I teach the best of the best to take care of their bodies because when I hit initial roadblocks, I refused to see my situation as a failure. You take what everyone else sees as a negative and turn it to your advantage. You don't sulk. You don't curl up and die. You glare at it and think, if it's not going to happen this way, it's sure as hell going to happen that way. And you tell anyone who doubts you, I got this. Just don't expect everyone else to understand or agree with your new plan. Most people are either content to stay with the safe thing, or they're too scared to leave a bad thing, and they'll put all that fear and doubt on you. They anticipate failure. You anticipate opportunity. When I decided to go into this field, everyone said, "Oh, a gym teacher." "No." "A personal trainer?" "No, I am not a personal trainer." "A personal trainer meets you at the gym for an hour, helps you with your workout, and sees you the next time you want an appointment. I work for my clients 7 days a week, 365 days a year, around the clock. You need me, I'm there. You can call me an architect or an athletic specialist." An architect constructs a building. I construct a body from the inside out. How do I rebuild that shoulder? How do I structure that physique so it's stronger and more durable and powerful than ever before? I'm a physical architect, responsible for every fiber of that mind and body you've entrusted to me. All because I failed as a basketball player. To me, success isn't about how much money I can make. It's never been about that. Success is about doing things that no one else can do. A couple of years ago, I spent the summer working with Robbie Hummel, who was playing for Purdue, a great kid who had just torn his ACL for the second time in 8 months. The first time, in 2010, he was a junior with just 8 games left in the season and was already considered one of the top players in the country. Determined to get back to the game, he went through surgery and rehab with trainers at school and returned to the Boilermakers that following season for his senior year, ready to play. At the very first team practice, he tore the ACL again. Out for the season, and possibly forever. 2 surgeries in 8 months? Returning from a double ACL injury? That's a lot of work for an uncertain outcome. There was talk that the promising career of the 6'8" All-American forward might be over. That's when his dad called me. Could I get him back to where he needed to be, so he could have one more shot as a fifth-year senior? I don't know anyone else in my business who has successfully rehabbed even one double ACL injury, but Robbie would be my third. I knew what we'd have to do for him. It would take months of commitment and serious mental toughness. His choice. For 7 months, he worked on that rehab 5 days a week, twice a day, at the Attack Athletics facility in Chicago and also back at school in Valparaiso. He'd drive an hour each way to see us, and I think he was a little stunned by how fast and hard we put him to work. "The first day I figured they'd talk to me and take my height and weight," he told reporters. "Within an hour, they had me puking in a trash can." Our goal was to have him at full strength by the start of Big Ten conference play for for the 2011-2012 season. People said it was impossible. His surgeon had cleared him to play, but he still had one test to pass for me before I'd give him the green light. A 48-inch jump down to the floor and back up. Same test I give all my guys after knee or ankle or hip rehab. The day he finally achieved that was the day we said goodbye and sent him back to school, good to go. Our job was done, and his was just beginning. Not only did he return to the game better than ever, he went on to be named first-team All-Big Ten for the third time in his career, ranking in the top 10 for scoring, rebounds, blocks, three-pointers, and free throws. And in his final appearance in the NCAA tournament, he dominated with 26 points, including 5 three-pointers, in a narrow loss to Kansas. By then, we were no longer working together, but I was so pleased for him when he was drafted in the second round of the NBA draft and then headed to Spain to start his professional career, where he promptly tore his meniscus. More surgery, more work, more commitment. A lot of guys would quit. He kept going. It's all a choice. I tell my athletes everything up front and let them decide whether to keep fighting or give up. Tracy McGrady was facing an 18-month process to rehab his knee, and he had to make a tough choice. Are you willing to give up 2 years of your career so when you're 40 or 50, you'll still have a perfect knee? Or are you willing to take a chance and cut those 18 months in half, work for a super strong knee that's going to last you through your whole career, and deal with the remaining issues when you're done playing? That's not a decision I can make for him, but no one ever chooses the longer rehab. In these cases, I offer choices, and the athletes have to decide what they want to do. You can be good by playing it safe. You can't be relentless unless you are willing to take chances. Safe makes you good. Chances make you great. Gilbert Arenas is another who decided to take the chance with his body. I told him, you have about 100 degrees flexion in this knee. 3 years from now, you're going to have about 90 degrees. 7 years from now, maybe 75. Gil's question, how much flexion do I need to play? I said around 45. He said, okay, I'm good. We knew we could get Gilbert back 100% because any individual who's willing to pack up all his stuff and relocate to Chicago to spend 3 months being tortured by me is already in the right frame of mind. And those huge decisions ultimately determine success or failure. Whom do they trust? The doctors have to give the full medical opinion for a complete recovery. They're going to treat your symptoms. I'm going to overcome the cause. The teams and sponsors want the guys back on the floor as fast as possible. The agents are thinking about how to play the situation so it works for the next contract. I just look at the damage, talk to everyone, and give the guys options. If you do this, you get this. If you do that, you get that. Here's what caused the injury. Here's what we'll do so it doesn't happen again. Your call. Being trusted with those life-altering, high-stakes decisions is what makes me feel successful. Money is nice, but it's better to help someone who doesn't have much time left to excel at something. I love a guy like Juwan Howard, who came into the league in 1994 and for almost 20 years worked his ass off year-round for the opportunity to get a ring, which he finally achieved with the Heat in 2012. You know how much work that takes in your late 30s? To stay in condition and keep making those teams just because you refuse to go down without that ultimate prize? That's a guy who refused to accept failure and came away a winner. With athletes, you have to realize that every day brings them closer to the end of their careers, closer to that decision about whether to walk away or go harder? How can I enhance whatever time they have left so they can be successful? That's where I look for my success. They all want it to last forever and see the end of their careers as some kind of loss. But it doesn't have to be, if they've put the pieces in place ahead of time. I've had this conversation over and over with guys nearing the end of their careers. I say, in 1 year you're going to be irrelevant. You'll leave a legacy as a player, but what does that mean when you get up every day with nothing to do? Figure it out now, before you're just another ex-player looking for attention. Your shoe deal won't last forever, and only so many guys are going to be able to coach or sit in the broadcast booth. What's your plan? How do you turn this great career into something even greater, so you can continue to be unstoppable for years to come? Do it now, because if you wait too long, those other options start slipping away. Other people are chasing the same ideas, and they're getting ahead of you while you cling to this old thing that's not working. A cleaner knows when to walk away and which direction to walk. Never running, always walking. He leaves smoothly and on his own terms. He can lose a battle because he's still planning to win the war. Lose a game, but win the season. Lose a season, come back and win the next three. Lose a job, start a new business. No one else is getting the last word on whether he succeeded. When you're a cleaner, you don't celebrate your achievements because you always want more. A cooler is the first to arrive at the celebration and the last to leave. A closer will make an appearance, then go out with his own crew. But a cleaner just wants to get back to work. I'm not here for the parade. By the time my client wakes up the next day drenched in party sweat and a champagne-soaked victory t-shirt, I'm long gone. We'll find each other for a couple of minutes when it's all over, and that's it. You good? I'm good. Done. Next? A cleaner's favorite words. There's always more work to do, and more to prove. Always more to prove. Let everyone else celebrate. You're still not satisfied. If you won in six, you're disappointed you didn't win in five. If you benched 195, why not 200? If you made a deal for $1 million, you'll keep wondering if you could have done it for $1.2 million. Never satisfied. On the rare occasions when you do feel like celebrating, it's a brief, private moment you don't share with anyone else because no one could possibly understand what you went through to get to that point. The others can celebrate because you made it all possible. They may not even realize that, but you do. Everything you accomplished, everything you worked for, you didn't do any of it for the celebration, and you didn't do it for anyone else. You did it for that exquisite moment, that electrifying, powerful surge of satisfaction that everyone dreams about, but few ever get to experience. Yet, the minute you experience it, it's already fading, and all you can think about is doing whatever it takes to get it back. It's that momentary feeling of enough, followed by a deep, hot surge of more. A cleaner knows the quiet melancholy of victory. While everyone else enjoys the win, he waits for the impending letdown, the unyielding reminder that the glory is already in the past, and there's a new challenge ahead, bigger and harder and more grueling than whatever he just completed. If you want to find the cleaner at a victory party, look for the guy standing off to the side by himself, watching everyone else. He's happy for them because they can go home feeling that their work is complete. But his is always just beginning. He's already thinking about the next move, the next risk, the next kill. Watch Pat Riley the next time he wins a title. No one looks more subdued at a celebration. He knows too well what it took to get there, and what has to be done to stay there. A true cleaner is at his lowest soon after he reaches his highest. For 5 minutes, he's completely exhilarated. For the next 24 hours, he's relatively happy. After that, what? Back to work. Everyone else will tell him he did a great job, and he knows it's true. But their approval means nothing to him because the standards he sets for himself are so much higher than anyone else can possibly set for him. Win or lose, all he thinks about is how he could have done it better, or smoother, or faster, or some other way than how he did it. So the job gets done, but he's still always thinking about how he could have done more. That's the relentless pursuit of excellence. Always believing in your ability, demanding more of yourself than anyone else could ever ask of you. Winning is an addiction. The great Vince Lombardi once said, "Winning is a habit," which is also true. But I think it's a habit that inevitably becomes the addiction. You can't understand it until you taste it, and then you can spend a lifetime craving more. You feel it in your gut, in the dull ache of your dark side begging for it. When you're alone in the zone, you know nothing except the unwavering hunger for success. Every choice you make, every sacrifice, every moment you spend alone preparing and learning and dreaming, it's all to feed that addiction. And if you ever once feel the need to question why it's necessary to work so hard, or wonder if it's all worth it, just go ahead and quit. You don't get it. It's hard to describe the enormity of winning when it's combined with the realization that to repeat the experience, you have to start all over again, go through the whole process, and work even harder for an uncertain outcome. When I first started working with Kobe, Juwan Howard went up to him after a game to say he'd been working with me for a long time and talked about how I had helped his longevity. Then he asked Kobe how many more years he wanted to play. "Until I get number 6," Kobe said. He didn't answer in years, which is what Juwan asked. He didn't answer by age or the length of his contract, which is how most players address that question. He answered in rings. He already had 3 at that point. He got 2 more the following seasons. As I write this, he needs 1 more to reach his goal. 2 more, if I have anything to say about it. That's the addiction. Others think about how many years are left on their contracts or how many seasons are left in their worn-down bodies. The great ones don't even consciously think about it. There's just one automatic response. Win. They don't think about if or when they'll hit their ceiling. They don't believe they have a ceiling. They just keep going, and they leave on their own terms, when they want to, not when anyone else tells them to. A few years ago, I was working with a player trying to come back after surgery, and he said to me, "I just want to get better so I can get even with everybody." Well, that got my attention. "Say that again," I said. "I just want to get even with everyone." "Define even," I said. "I want to get back at all these people who said I couldn't do it." "You know what even means?" I asked. "It means you're equal to them, right next to them, side by side." Silence. "Do you truly want to get even with everyone, or do you really want to get ahead of them? Why stand next to anyone when you can push beyond them? In the game of basketball, you get around someone so you can get past them. Play this game the same way. You go for the win, you don't settle for a tie." He got it. Not everyone does. Think about the people you know who are so talented and gifted and capable, yet completely void of the ability to advance, as if an invisible cap were over them. Most people allow themselves to be limited that way, either by what others tell them or what they think of themselves. And they decide they can settle for whatever they have under that cap. My job is to get you to bump up that cap. In everything you do, I want you better and stronger than the last time you did it. When a player comes to me and says, "I'm going to get a triple-double tonight," and then he goes out and gets the triple-double, and everyone gets all excited, all I can think is, "What was stopping you last night?" A cleaner performs for himself, and everyone else wins. Whatever he does to satisfy his goals internally transfers to them externally. When he achieves what he desires, everyone else around him benefits. If he's the boss and his company makes a massive profit because he worked around the clock maneuvering a huge deal, his employees win. He's the guy who hits the game-winning shot because he practiced that damn shot 1,000 times every single fucking day. And his teammates get to go home winners. But they'll celebrate, and he won't, because he'll be looking at the stat sheet, skimming over the positive stuff, and going straight to the negative. 30 points, 10 assists, damn, 2 turnovers. And that's all he's going to remember. Oh, the night I had 2 turnovers. He played a near-perfect game, but to him, not perfect enough. The drive to close the gap between near-perfect and perfect is the difference between great and unstoppable. You never shake the uneasy feeling that you can't ever be satisfied with your results. You always believe you could have done better, and you stop at nothing to prove it. Is it an ideal way to live? I don't know. It's not easy, that's for sure. You hope your family and friends ultimately understand. They might not. Your whole life is essentially dedicated to one goal, to the exclusion of everything else. Whether you're focused on business, sports, relationships, anything, you have to be committed to saying, "I'm doing this. I'll give up whatever I have to give up so I can do this. I don't care what anyone thinks. And if there are consequences that affect the other parts of my life, I'll deal with them when I have to." That's Kobe. Everything he does is all about excellence. Everything. Nothing else matters. You hear people say that all the time, "I'll do whatever it takes." But he truly lives it. Every detail of his life, every hour of his day, the lonely time he spends in the gym, the people he seeks out to help him maintain that excellence, everything revolves around being on top and staying there. That's why we work so well together. He has one focus, and I have one focus, our shared addiction to winning. And everything we do is about that one objective. But when you're never satisfied, life can be lonely. People think success will make them happy, but when you experience it, it's usually different from what you imagined. You'll have what you desire, but be prepared for the possibility that you'll be standing alone because you have the balls to take the unpopular path and you went to extremes that others won't ever understand. You'll finally have everything you dreamed of, but now you'll know for sure what you suspected all along. Nobody else understands what you went through or what you did to get there. To me, never being satisfied means being prepared for any situation, ready to adapt seamlessly without panic or fluster. It means scrutinizing every detail, paying meticulous attention to things no one else would even notice. I don't have to watch the ball go into the basket. I know from looking at the shot whether it's going in. That's my job, to show you why your wrist needs to be here and your elbow needs to be there, why this shot isn't working and that shot is perfect. I show my players how it all works together, and they can't believe it. That's what separates me from anyone else. I never overlook the details, and I'll make sure you don't either. But when you live and work that way, it can take its toll. And one of the biggest challenges facing highly competitive people is burnout. You win that prize, you make your money, you get the glory. It can be awfully tempting to lie down and let someone else carry the load for a while. The pressure, the scrutiny, the strain on your personal life. It affects just about everyone. If you work in anything other than sports, you have options. Change jobs, change careers, take a sabbatical, go back to school, learn a new part of your business. In sports? Forget it, unless your talent and skills are so extreme that you can afford the time away, such as Michael going to play baseball. To me, that's what made him the greatest. He had the ability to control time when he was in the zone, and he was always in the zone. He left and returned, refined his basketball skills, and it was as if nothing had changed. But otherwise, athletes don't have the luxury of time. They only get a few short years to leave their mark, and they're done before most people their age are just getting started. At some point, though, every elite athlete just gets tired of putting in the relentless work it takes to be exceptional. It's especially common with athletes who've become successful at a young age, such as tennis players and Olympians, who feel they never got the chance to be kids because they were always working and training and traveling and competing. If you never had a chance to be a kid, you want that for yourself, because it's completely instinctive to want to have fun, ignore the rules, and just forget about responsibility and goals and performance. I get that. But I'm convinced childhood is overrated. You can have a much better childhood as an adult when you have the freedom and the affluence to enjoy it. You get this small window to be a legend, and you have the rest of your life to act like a kid, at any age. Push it as far as you can, and even if you make it until you're 30 or 35, you still have decades ahead to enjoy what you built for yourself. Some athletes know they're done, and that's it. But when that burnout hits a guy who isn't done, it's extremely hard for him to find his way back to where he was. Maybe he won a title, took it easy during the off-season, and returned the next year feeling a little content and satisfied. Usually only one thing can bring him back: the competitive spirit, the idea that someone else is about to take what's his. The realization that while he was content to get fat and lazy, everyone else was still lean and hungry. Then he has to get busy playing catch-up, or he won't be the champ for long. In Michael's Hall of Fame induction speech, I heard him say something that made me think, "I thought we were done, but now I'm not really sure." I'm still not sure. I'll be ready just in case. A cleaner feels burnout like everyone else, but the idea of walking away and not thinking about what he walked away from creates more anxiety and stress than keeping it going. That addiction is still demanding to be fed. That's why you see guys retire and return. They're still not satisfied, and they still have something to prove. Not to you, but to themselves. The pressure is all internal. You have to crave that pressure, embrace it, and never let up. You don't have to love it. You just have to be insatiable for the results. I've accomplished and experienced enough impossible things to realize that nothing is impossible, and every day I crave the challenge of proving it. It's why I only train athletes and not Hollywood celebrities. Everything I do is about performance, and when my guys step out there, there's no makeup, no script, no hiding. Whatever happens, it's out there for everyone to see. Actors and actresses can have their flaws and mistakes airbrushed and edited out. My guys have nowhere to hide. I love that pressure. I love getting these athletes ready to go and seeing all our hard work turn into a masterpiece with the world watching. I loved getting Michael in shape to play baseball, and then back into basketball shape so he could win 3 more rings to go with the first 3. I loved taking Kobe to the highest level and beyond, so he could chase his dream for that 4th and 5th championship, and still keep going for more. Loved running into Pat Riley the night Miami won the 2012 championship, and having him ask me how I got Dwayne so explosive in just a few short days. You give me a situation, I will make it work. That's what drives me. A new challenge every time. A new way to do things better than we did before. I'll admit, it's not easy to impress me, and it's hard to teach me anything I can't learn on my own. But one person teaches me every day and challenges me in ways I never dreamed imaginable. And that's my beautiful and bright daughter, Pilar. She's my living proof that emotions make you weak, because when it comes to her, I'm just a daddy in love with this little girl. She's smart and beautiful, like her mother. And she's my reason for coming back from the dark side of intensity and competition and unyielding pressure into the light and love she melts me with every day of my life. My deepest wish is that everything I do makes her as proud of me as I am of her. I'm telling you that because my advice to my daughter is the same advice I pass along to you, so you know it's the truth. It goes like this. Every dream you imagine, everything you see and hear and feel in your sleep, that's not a fantasy. That's your deep instinct telling you it can all be real. Follow those visions and dreams and desires and believe what you know. Only you can turn those dreams into reality. Never stop until you do. The greatest battles you will ever fight are with yourself, and you must always be your toughest opponent. Always demand more of yourself than others demand of you. Be honest with yourself, and you'll be able to meet every challenge with confidence and the deep belief that you are prepared for anything. Life can be complicated. The truth is not. I truly believe I have 0 limitations. You should believe the same about yourself. Listen to your instincts. They're telling you the truth. I want the satisfaction of knowing that every move I make, every thought, every idea, every action takes me further than anyone else has ever gone and makes me better at what I do than anyone else in the world. That's what drives me. Whatever drives you, let it take you where you want to be. Everything you want can be yours. Be a cleaner and go get it. Be relentless. Done. Next. This concludes Relentless by Tim S. Grover. Narrated by Sean Pratt. Copyright 2013 by Relentless Publishing, LLC. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Simon & Schuster, Incorporated, and was produced in the year 2014 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, which holds the copyright there too. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers. Or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalog.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.